Thank you, Vaman, for inviting me and for the introduction. And thanks for all the wonderful talks I heard throughout the day. Actually, what I'm going to say is relevant to or piggybacks on many of the talks I've heard. I think the subjects of pluralism and the perennial philosophy have been talked about quite a bit today. We've moved around these subjects quite a bit. But the integral, that in a sense is one of the contributions of Haridas Chaudhary, and he got it from Sri Aurobindo. And the notion of the integral is something which is very, in some sense, necessary to understand either pluralism or the perennial. So how can we think the integral relative to both these things is what I'd like to reflect on. And how is this getting played out, and what can we do to approach it as a discipline? Because when we study it as an academic discipline, what does it mean to look at the integral? I think I'm really happy Hillary talked about the orange with the mystical top, the polar region. But I'd like to start by thinking about one perennialist, in fact, a contemporary perennialist, and this is Robert Foreman, who perhaps many of you have heard of. He's perhaps really one of the most important contemporary exponents of the perennial school. And he has posited what he calls the PCE, or pure consciousness event. And so that's what he says. All traditions, all experience, all sort of mystical experiences touch the pure consciousness event. And he's reduced the whole field of mystical experience. I use the term reduced not necessarily in a pejorative manner, though that shade also can be read into it, to three kinds of experiences. One he calls theistic, the other monistic, and the third nihilistic. Though, again, the word not used in a pejorative sense, but in the sense of experiences of the nothing. So he claims that these three, I mean, varieties of experiences can basically be reduced to these three kinds of mystical approaches to spirit. And they all end up in what he calls the pure consciousness event. Now, the differences that arise in the expression, according to him, come due to the psychology, the psychological makeup, the nature of the approach, and the cultural traditions from which these approaches come. So this is a certain kind of way by which perennialism and pluralism have been approached by some of the contemporary thinkers in perennial thinking. But I'd like to posit another kind of way of thinking the perennial and the plural, which cannot necessarily reduce it in this manner. And also, even if reduced, the question of the pure consciousness event remains something which needs to be thought of at the same time as we think of this plural space of approach. And in thinking and trying to think about an example, the one that I could come up with is Krishna's vision or darshan in the Bhagavad Gita. In this apocalyptic vision, Arjuna says to Krishna in this sort of through this debate of the Bhagavad Gita, which goes back and forth in Arjuna's trying to get convinced as to why he should take up arms. At a culminating position, Krishna shows to him his form, his Vishwarupa. And he says, Arjuna asks him to show him that form. Who is it that is talking to me? I mean, this it boils down to this. What is your power? really, to ask me to do this thing. And he says, well, I'll give you the sight that no human being has had as yet. Let me bestow upon you the divine sight, Divya Drishti, Divya Chakshu, the divine eye. And Arjuna sees something, and the Bhagavad Gita tries to describe it. And its description is purely paradoxical. Its description is one in which there is the one and the many that coexist. Basically, what Arjuna says is, I see in front of me this enormous infinite radiance extending on all sides. I see all the gods, all the humans, all the sages in your body. He sees impersonality, personality, past, present, and future. He sees that which can be expressed and that which cannot be expressed. And he cannot take it. So he says, he bows down and says, take this vision away from me. I wish to see you in your four-handed form. Now, Sri Aurobindo comments on this in the essays on the Gita. And he says, evidently this vision was given to Arjuna at a time when he was not prepared for it. You know, he hadn't been prepared for it. He was a person who was bestowed this vision like a gift, like an acid trip. Some of you may think of. That's probably why Jimi Hendrix put on that album cover, Bold as Love, right? Vishwarupa. But nevertheless, this is the fact. I mean, he got something that he didn't prepare for. But at the same time, when he asks about the four-handed form, what he gets is the universal form, Sri Aurobindo says. That's what he's doing. That's the four-handed form. Why four-handed? I'll come to that in a moment. But nevertheless, the four-handed form is the universal form, and he gets that particular form, the cosmic Vishnu, Vasudeva. Now, this kind of an image, the image in which Arjuna beholds Sri Krishna, is the supermind, is the supramental image. No, the first one, the one in which, the paradoxical one. It is paradoxical because mind can't encompass it. The plural and the perennial cannot be grasped by mind at the same time. We cannot think plurality and unity at the same time. We can think of it in terms of the plural hiding the one, or the one swallowing up the many. See, and these are the various ways in which people have approached these two traditions. But Sri Aurobindo talks about the integral. When we think about the loaded significance of this term, that's what it means. The integral is that in which the perennial and the plural are conserved. They're not, one doesn't erase the other. One doesn't get reduced by the other. So here, the first thing to recognize or realize is that we are really not up to the integral. We are not up to the integral in our psychological makeup. This is exactly why the integral yoga has been proposed, why it's a yoga of evolution. Basically, what's being told is this is exactly where our aporias meet. This is our aporetic experience. We need to have it, but we can't have it because we don't have it. See? So the experience that can really save is not the savior of an avatar. It is the growth of consciousness that can bring us that evolutionary point in which this integrality, integral consciousness can be had. Now, in thinking about that, we go back to the notion of what is integral philosophy, integral psychology, integral theory, because that's the other popular coinage of people like, I think, Ken Wilber. And how the integral enters the academy, the modern academy. Because the modern academy comes with its own expectations. It's a discourse. And anything entering that discourse has to follow the boundaries of the discourse. The modern academy is a product of the Enlightenment. And the entire trajectory of the Enlightenment is one in which we are knowledge workers. Anybody in academia is a knowledge worker, yoked to the enterprise of coming up with the one theory that will explain everything. Okay. Approach through the mind. Now, it's interesting because, as a matter of fact, that very definition is the Upanishadic definition of knowledge. What is that, knowing which all else may be known? But it is proposed in the Upanishad as a mystical experience, a paradoxical experience. It is a paradoxical statement. Entering the academy, it becomes a rational and understandable statement. You see, what is the knowledge by which all may be known? In other words, what is that system? What is that largest fragment which is the piecing, the jigsaw puzzle, piecing together of fragments by which the whole may be known? There is no such fragment. It will always remain a fragment. We can enlarge the fragment, but we will never get the whole. It's a difference in kind, not a difference in degree. So this is something which happens when the integral enters the academy. We create a structure for it. That structure is called integral philosophy. It may be called integral psychology. It may be called integral theory. It becomes most dangerous when it becomes a theory in which we try to classify things, people, classes, races, etc., according to their degree of progress towards the integral. Okay. It becomes another religion. And it becomes worse than most other religions because it becomes a totalitarian religion. It becomes a brief theory of everything. Yeah. Now, having said that, let me move on and talk about how else we can approach it. And then also about why it is that such a philosophy exists at all, even in the writings of Sri Aurobindo. Because one could say the life divine is such a philosophy. It is an integral philosophy. It exists because, again, it's part of a discourse. But this discourse is a very different discourse. It's the discourse of Indian knowledge, Indian epistemology. And that discourse proceeds by positing as two wings the theory and the practice. You see, darshan and yoga. Without yoga, there is no darshan. Darshan has no right to exist without yoga, and yoga subordinates darshan. And so, to create an integral philosophy without creating at the same time a practice for the individual, not a certain kind of a therapeutical practice, not a practice to bring that which is outside the norm into the norm, see, but a practice to exceed the human limitation, such a theory has no value. So Sri Aurobindo provides, along with that kind of integral theory, integral philosophy, the philosophy of the planes of consciousness, or the philosophy of the plane of consciousness that can provide the integration of the plural and the non-plural and the unitary, the way to it, which is known as the triple transformation. The triple transformation is given to us as a practice for the individual. Then one can see that in this form, or in the form of this practice, or to the form of this practice, there is a map. And what we call integral philosophy, or what is given to us in the life divine as the map of consciousness, the map of cosmic and supramental consciousness, is really an aid to the triple transformation. Without seeing it in that fashion, we've actually created a dangerous monster by pulling into a different discourse something that was not meant for it. By giving it something which its hubris immediately claims for itself. Now, on the other hand, if we look at the triple transformation, we find that, again, we come close in a sense to the perennialist school, but now in a different way. When we were talking about Forman's reduction to the theist or the theistic, the monistic, and the nihilistic, we can now come back and look at the triple transformation in terms of the three dimensions of spiritual experience. The depth dimension, the width dimension, and the height dimension. These are the three spatial dimensions of mystical space. The depth dimension is that which plunges us into the deepest or innermost being in us. This is the immanent divine. And out of the immanent divine, the psychic being, the person in us, the innermost person in us. The experience of the person, of this person, and the utilization of that consciousness to transform matter, life, and mind. See, that angle or that approach, the perennialists miss out, the approach of transformation. It is as if identity of consciousness is enough. It isn't. The transformation of body, life, and mind, first by the identity with the depth dimension. The identity with the width dimension is the cosmic consciousness. The width dimension is everywhere in us. There is a cosmic or universal physical, there is a universal vital, a universal mental. But it's not until we come to the overmind that we get the total sense of the cosmic consciousness. The cosmic consciousness that includes the rest of them. And hence, when we talk about monism, that really is the true monism, the monism of overmind. There is another monism, which is the monism of Satchidananda. Entering the monism of Satchidananda, we enter into an exclusivity which loses the other dimensions. A pure theism can lose a pure monism just like, you know, all the dualistic schools. They lose the monism and that which is beyond the monism. A pure monism loses the theism as well as that which is beyond it. So instead of a nihilism, the third component that completes the height dimension is the rise to supermind. Supermind is that logos posited upon the unfathomable Satchidananda that gives order to a manifestation. It is that ordering consciousness, part of the Supreme, that Sri Aurobindo calls upon, specially or specifically, because that can unite the differences. And so the seeking for these three kinds of experiences, if you reduce it to that, are these dimensions of experience and transformation at each level, can be undertaken separately, though he puts it forth in a kind of sequence, as if one needs to do the psychic, sort of the first transformation first, then the second, and then the third. But at least the first two can be approached simultaneously and have been approached simultaneously. It's Sri Aurobindo's own case. He starts, of course, with the second. In the mother's case, she starts with the first. But the approach to each of these is something that one can approach from any tradition. It's not necessarily to do the integral yoga. One can approach it through any tradition. And I would say what is needed in today's world, if you're talking about its entry into an academic discourse, is to create a phenomenology of experience. that respects these three dimensions of mystical space as the precursor to arriving at integrality. It is only when our language culture changes to a point where we can express these dimensions of mystical experience in the currency of communication that we can say that academia can house a true integral psychology or a true integral philosophy. Before that, to talk of it to some extent is aporetic. And if it isn't seen as that, it is dangerous. I think that's all I wanted to say.